This is Talk Is Cheap here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. I'm your host, DJ Susti, and today, thanks to Todd Boyle, local videographer here in Eugene, Oregon, I have activist philanthropist Chuck Collins, recorded here in Eugene in April 17th. So stay tuned for that on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also at kepw.org. Support independent media any way you can. These shows are uploaded on radioforall.net. Alright, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Coming up, Chuck Collins. Let me try something here for you. Alright, Talk Is Cheap is brought to you by Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Built on a site where an actual ancient rainforest once stood, see a full-scale replica of a Douglas fir tree. See pictures of trees larger in diameter than a man is tall. Hear trout and salmon that once choked the rivers of the Northwest sing to you in our Hall of Taxidermy. Hear the disaffected sounds of Feller Buncher and his bunch of fellers, an all-ex-logger band in our simulated wood amphitheater. Take the Oregon Desert Highway to the clear-cut road exit, turn right at the stump in the road, and you're at Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Free parking, kids a buck and a half, closed during summer months due to melting asphalt, giant locusts, and methyl ethyl colchicine slag emissions. Coming up, Chuck Collins, Eugene, April 17th.
Thank you, Gina Turner and Melissa and Peg and the team at the Humanity Center for hosting me, getting me here, getting all of you out on a beautiful sunny evening. I understand you haven't seen it a lot lately, so I'm happy I could bring some sunshine your way. I'm here to talk with you about this moment that we're in. I would call it a moment of extreme, extraordinary inequality of income, wealth, an opportunity and what it means and what we can do to reverse it. But I want to say, I think that the discussion about inequality sometimes can be polarized, stuck, and that I and even raising the question of, you know, is there a concentration of wealth in this country elicits concerns, or that, you know, I'm going to come out and talk about class warfare, class envy. So let me start by just saying, you know, I grew up in the 1%. My great-grandfather was the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. So my dad used to say, bringing home the bacon means something different in our family. And I still go to our big family reunion where, you know, I put on my lederhosen and stand in front of with a group family picture in front of the Wienermobile with, you know, 350 of my closest relatives. So we're still a very, very close-knit family. But I say that because I want you to know I grew up in a bubble of privilege. I grew up in a wealthy suburb of Detroit, Bloomfield Hills, Michigan. I went to a boys' prep school, Cranbrook School. Our school motto was aim high, which is depicted by an archer shooting an arrow straight into the air, which if you think about it, says it all. One of my older classmates was a guy named Mitt Romney, and he certainly aimed high, I thought, in terms of his aspirations. But, you know, that whole socialization, that experience was, you know, to prepare me as a young man born on third base. I'd won the lottery at birth, and I'm going to be prepared to take my place at the head of the table. And that was really the socialization that I grew up with, except for a couple of things. One was we lived next to Detroit. And in 1967, when I was 7 years old, the Detroit uprising, the riots erupted, and my mom, in her great sensibility, when I was pestering her, why is this happening? She said, this has to do with the fact that things are not fair in this city. And I knew, even at seven, what she meant, the gap between city and suburb, rich and poor, black and white. And that planted this little seed in my own understanding. And I really have just looked at the world through that lens of an inequality. An interesting thing happened to me when I was about in my mid-20s. I had a job working with mobile home park tenants who owned their mobile homes but did not own the land in their parks. They didn't own their parks. And my job was to help them figure out how to buy their parks and own them as resident-owned cooperatives. And in the process of that, I got to know the intimate financial secrets of hundreds of low-income New Englanders, because I was the one who sat down with everybody in the park and said, what's your savings? What's your income? What can you afford to pay toward the purchase of the park? What can you afford to pay on a monthly basis? And it really gave me, in the mid-80s, a window into how people were struggling and surviving as real wages started to stagnate and flatten. And for those of you who were around in those days, you know, we really, between, you know, the end of World War II into the mid-70s, we really did live through a period of relative rising tide, lifting all boats. The bottom fifth, the middle, and the top all grew relatively, saw their incomes grow at roughly the same rate. But starting in the late 70s and going into the 80s, real wages started to flatten out. So I had this intimate front row seat into how working people were struggling to survive in the growing unequal economy. But also growing up in a wealthy family, I had an intimate front row seat into the lives of my classmates, of my family and friends, who would say things like, you know, we bought that house up north for X, and we just sold it for 30X, and we bought another house. Or we're invested in a fund that's earning 30-40% returns. And I sort of had this experience of like seeing wealth creating wealth and what that meant in the lives of people I knew. And it ultimately led me to a radical decision, because I worked with these mobile home tenants in some situations where to buy their parks, they had to come together and put every nickel they had together on the table. And there was something in that process of watching people exhibit an intense solidarity, a commitment to one another, a willingness to be all in for one another, that inspired me. And in a way, I wanted what some of those people had. I wanted that sense of community and reciprocity. And I began to think that maybe this wealth that I had been privileged to receive was an impediment or a barrier to me having the kind of authentic relationships of connection that I wanted. So I made this decision when I was 27 to give away the inheritance. And I won't talk much about that, but I can later if people are interested. But that's just to give you an understanding that when I talk about these issues of inequality, or when I talk about people in the 1%, I'm talking about people I love, people I know, people I respect, many people who I would want to be on my team to solve any civic problem. So I don't hate wealthy people. I actually love some of them very dearly. And I do think we are in a stuck place, and I want to talk about how to move forward. But first, let's just take a look now. What's the picture? 2019, what is the nature of the inequality that we're living with? Well, as I mentioned, for now over four decades, real wages, paychecks, have been flat. Half the population has not shared in the economic gains of the last 40 years. They've not shared in the productivity gains since the iPhone and the advent of the internet. And that means there's a lot of people who've been left behind and feel a deep sense of betrayal when it comes to looking around at the prosperity that others enjoy. But the other piece of the story, and that's sometimes left out, is what's happening at the top. There, really, since the economic meltdown of 2008, most of the gains in income and wealth have gone not to the top 1%, but the top 1/10 of 1%. People in the top 1/10 of 1% have incomes over 3 million, wealth over 20 million. Most of their income comes not from wages and salaries. More than half of it comes from owning wealth. The higher up we go up the economic ladder, the more concentrated the income and wealth becomes. The 400 wealthiest people in the United States, all billionaires, their combined wealth is equal to 64% of the population combined, the bottom 64. 400 billionaires, their combined wealth is equal to all the wealth owned by all the African Americans in the United States, plus a third of all the Latinos. 400 billionaires. And 3 billionaires, Bezos, Buffett, and Gates, their combined wealth is equal to the combined wealth of the bottom half of U.S. households. I'm not making this up. The reason that's possible is because there are so many households that have so little. There are 21% of households are what I call part of underwater nation. They have zero or negative wealth. 21%, one out of five households, zero or negative wealth. 37% of African American households. 33% of Latino households. Zero or negative wealth. So that's how it's possible for three people to have as much wealth as the bottom 50% of U.S. households. We have a extraordinary racial wealth divide, which actually has its own history and dynamics that really goes back to the ultimate disenfranchisement and you know, slavery, Jim Crow, separate but unequal, the legacy of discrimination in wealth building and housing. So today, the median white family has 41 times the wealth of the median black family and 22 times the wealth of the median Latino family. So that's the picture. That's the picture today, 2019. But as Thomas Piketty said, if we don't intervene in the machinery now, the systemic inequalities that are essentially keeping wages suppressed and funneling wealth to the top, that a generation from now, we will be a society, we will be a hereditary aristocracy of wealth, where the sons and daughters of today's billionaires dominate our politics, our economy, philanthropy, and culture. You may be thinking, aren't we there already? But in fact, we will become more so. That if we don't intervene into these cycles of growing inequality, we will become an economic and racial apartheid society that, in my view, none of us will want to live in, even those we might think of as the beneficiaries, the most wealthy people, will not want to live in the kind of polarized, calcified, and extremely unequal society that we will become. Do these inequalities matter? When I first started doing this work, people used to debate this point. People would say to me, well, I understand poverty matters, but does it matter how wealthy the wealthy are? I can now tell you, without taking much time, there's now a mountain of research, interdisciplinary research, in every area that shows that the concentration of wealth and power is distorting and undermining everything we care about. It's bad for our health. It's bad for the health of the wealthy. It's bad for our democracy, clearly. When so few people have so much power, It in some ways, I think, explains the election that we lived through 2 years ago. When there's rising economic inequality and insecurity, it gives root to a regressive and progressive populism. So you see the anger and reflection of both, support for Bernie Sanders and a focus here, and Trump and the regressive populism. And regressive populism, why it's the oldest story in the book. It's the history of when things become unequal and unstable, let us shift the focus. Let us scapegoat someone who has less power, less advantage. It's the oldest story in the book. It's the roots and history of anti-Semitism that deflect and blame. But that inequality is what underlies the condition of what we're going through. It has an effect on social cohesion. It supercharges the existing inequalities that exist in terms of gender and race and other differences. It stalls out social mobility. It keeps people in their castes with less mobility. It's even bad for the economy in so many ways. Sometimes I have friends who are entrepreneurs or business people, and they say, you know, I worry about inequality, but I worry about some of the solutions that people are proposing because of the unintended consequences. It might hurt the economy. It might kill the goose that laid the golden egg. And I tell them about my friend Peter Georgesco, the retired CEO of Rubicam & Young, a big ad agency. He's a business leader who is outspoken on these issues of inequality. And Peter says to me, oh yeah, I have a lot of business leader friends of mine that say that too. What I tell them is, extreme inequality is killing the goose. Extreme inequality is creating volatility, undermining prosperity, undermining healthy economic activity. Working people don't have money to participate in the economy. People are consuming based on net, not on debt, not based on real wages going up. All those things contribute to negative economy. So, what can we do about this? One important thing is to get the diagnosis right. There's been a big debate about inequality. What are the causes? There's a fairly large body of work that says inequality is a function of some people having the skills that they need to participate in the new economy and others not, and that we are rewarding people who have high tech skills and are engaging in the new economy, and therefore, if that's the diagnosis, then the solution is investing in low-wage workers, investing in education and training, and moving those workers up the wage ladder. But actually, I think it's at this point we're in a new stage. that the drivers of these inequalities are, and if I were to put it on a bumper sticker, it would be that the rules of the economy have been changed to benefit asset owners, wealth holders, at the expense of wage earners. The rules of the economy, tax policy, trade policy, globalized trade policy, technological investments, rules like what government spends its money on, regulation, those rules, think of them almost as dials on the economy, have been tilted to funnel wealth to the very top. If you understand the systemic drivers of inequality as policy-rooted, politically rooted, not a function of technological change, then you have a different set of solutions. You have a different prescription for fixing that. We can reverse these inequalities. We actually know quite a bit about how to do that. We know something from our own U.S. experience, because in the 30 years after World War II, as I mentioned, the rising tide more or less lifted all boats. Some of you maybe have heard a speech like this. Under the socialist presidency of Dwight Eisenhower, the wealthiest 1% paid 3 times as much income tax, twice as much inheritance tax, and it was invested in public goods, infrastructure, debt-free higher education, loans for first-time homebuyers that built middle-class prosperity. You ever heard that? So, we actually, as a society, tipped the rules to build shared prosperity and build a middle class, largely a white middle class, in the years, decades after World War II. We also know other countries, other capitalist industrialized countries, have significantly less inequality than the United States. How is that true? Well, like the Nordic countries or Canada, 3 things. They have a higher floor. They have a greater floor of decency, a social safety net, higher minimum wage, universal health insurance, things that ensure that low-income people, people who lose their job, go through a divorce, have an illness, don't fall all the way to destitution. So they have less inequality because the floor is higher. But they also make investments in things that create social mobility and opportunity, and they pay attention to the growth and concentration of wealth at the top and tax high incomes and wealth at progressive levels and invest it in those public goods. So we also know from countries that are operating across our border, not far away, what we can learn to reduce extreme inequality. So we know we need to raise the floor, the move to raise the minimum wage, to expand health insurance to cover everyone, to deal with issues around family leave and health issues for workers, all these things that we can do to have a greater floor of decency. We know we have a long way to go to reverse the decline in social mobility. You may have heard the American dream move to Canada. The American dream, the idea that you should not have to be born wealthy to have a decent life in the United States, the American dream, so simple, that you work and you have health insurance, you work and maybe you can retire before you die, you can purchase a home, you can leave something for your children. It's a fairly simple dream. And yet, if you're not born wealthy and you want to have that American dream, you are better off living in Canada today, where they make investments in early childhood education, they make investments in higher education, so that people who are not born wealthy can have a decent life. But we're not going to be able to reverse the inequalities we're living in just by raising the floor and just by making those investments, because now we're living with a corrosive concentration of wealth and power. And so we have to do something to address the top. And mostly that brings us into the category of taxation. Although there's a very interesting group of work happening around how do we expand worker ownership? How do we pre-distribute wealth by broadening the ownership of companies? And there's really interesting work, and we know it has a huge impact. Some of you may have seen the Chobani Yogurt CEO, who at a certain point gave 10% of the company's stock to his most committed employees, making some of them millionaires overnight. But there's a whole move of organizing private-owned companies owned by retiring baby boomers to sell those companies, instead of selling them to private equity firms, sell them to the workers, work to broaden the wealth in that way. Cooperative ownership, worker ownership, different forms of sharing the wealth in the ownership and design of a company. Very important work, a lot of that work happening here in Oregon. But in terms of tax policy, we're going to have to do something to address the concentration of wealth and power. And I have to say I'm enlivened by the debate in the last couple of months. There are some incredibly bold proposals some of the Democratic candidates for president have put forward. Senator Elizabeth Warren proposed a wealth tax, an annual wealth tax on wealth over $50 million, a 2% tax, 3% on wealth over $1 billion, would raise almost $3 trillion over a decade. Senator Sanders has a proposal to take the estate tax, our nation's inheritance tax, a levy on inherited wealth, and make it more progressive and close some of the loopholes that the wealthy have used to get around paying it. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has floated the idea of a new top tax rate of 70% on incomes over $10 million. And U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky just introduced that proposal in Congress last week. So these are ideas that are not only will begin to, I call them the plutocracy prevention program. You know, if you think of tax policy as an ecosystem, a little bit of a whack-a-mole game, you know, you can't just kind of tweak one tax here because, boom, the wealth is going to move somewhere else. What happens, wealthy people will, you increase the income tax to 70%, they're going to turn their income into capital gains income, and it's going to flow over here. So you need to have a proposal that addresses capital gains. You can't simply address income. We also have to address the wealth disparity. So the plutocracy prevention program really, by necessity, has a number of components. One of my favorite ideas is, why not have a surcharge on incomes over $3 million, a 10% surcharge, basically falls only on the top 0.1%. Again, would raise $70 billion a year, 700,000 over a decade, significant revenue that would be raised by those. So those are real proposals, and the good news is they're wildly popular. 70-80% of voters support these ideas. A majority of Republicans support the idea of a high income tax rate on incomes over $10 million. So you may be saying, well, why aren't we moving forward? It's obvious, right? The national political system in the moment is captured by big money. It's captured by political donors who want to block these changes. But the good news is there is a undercurrent, a realignment happening. People are waking up to the dangers of these inequalities and coming together and working in states and localities and cities to lay the groundwork. And ultimately, this will lead to a political realignment at the national level. No promises, no guarantees. Things could still go very badly. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, there's, you know, a whole generation of younger people who are pushing forward and pushing these ideas. I want to lift up what I think of as some of the most inspiring, game-changing campaigns that people are working on. Down the road in California, thousands of college students are coming together. They've organized something called the California College for All Coalition. Their big, bold idea is to restore the California estate tax paid by people with wealth over $5 million. Couples with $10 million or more will pay an estate tax that will raise over $4 billion for free higher education in the community college, public, state, and university systems in California. Again, these students are working hard. I work with a coalition of them at San Jose State. I've gotten to know a dozen of these students. Several of them live in their cars. Several of them don't know where they're going to get their next meal, but they are willing to organize and fight for college for all, and that will help not just them, but future generations of California, restore California to its past glory as a tremendous public university system. Oregon, take note. We have a problem, which is that a huge amount of wealth is vanishing into offshore hidden wealth mechanisms. Well, where is all these trillions of dollars going? There's an estimated $10 trillion that the super wealthy, not just from the United States, but from around the world, is now hiding in offshore tax havens, trusts, shell corporations. Guess what? Some of that wealth is right here. It's being invested in luxury housing. It's buying land around the country. In the coastal cities, we're seeing a glut of luxury housing that's being built, not for people to live in, but simply as wealth storage units. Global wealth is touching down from all over the world in the United States, in these cities, and activists in those cities are coming together to say, okay, in exchange for babysitting your wealth, we would like to levy a vacancy tax, a real estate transfer tax, a luxury real estate transfer tax, requirements that beneficial owners disclose, you know, we know who's buying these properties. They want to make it as hard to buy a luxury corporation, a luxury real estate with a shell corporation, as it is to get a library card. In Boston, if I want to get a library card, I have to prove who I am and where I live. To create a shell corporation in Delaware and buy a luxury condominium, you don't have to do either. And so now we have, you know, trillions of dollars of illicit funds, hidden wealth flowing into our economy, disrupting our local housing markets. Let's generate that revenue and direct it to permanently affordable housing in our communities. That is a big idea that's taking off in a number of coastal communities and is a great example of people acting where they have agency to reduce inequality. One of the challenges we're up against is not just these policies and the ideas and the power that it's going to take to change things, but the stories that we tell about inequality. You may have had this experience. You might tell somebody the facts, just as I told you, about the concentration of wealth, and people say, well, that's troubling, but the people at the top deserve what they get, and the people who don't deserve to be where they are. Anybody heard that, had that kind of conversation? You know, the oil billionaire J. Paul Getty was once asked, how do you become wealthy in America? And he said, you know, it's really quite simple. There's three things you have to do. We can do a little poll here. One, get up early every morning. How many of you got up early this morning? Two, work hard all day, including going to like a night lecture. Three, find oil. Just as I thought. Bunch of us. So people hear these statistics about inequality and they say, well, some people got up early. Some people worked hard all the day. Some people took risks. Some people are more creative and work harder. And there's sort of the shadow corollary. Other people didn't do that. In fact, if I were going to put the great mythology of deservedness on a bumper sticker, it's people are where they deserve to be. People who have a lot of wealth are virtuous. Let's be clear. These extreme levels of income and wealth inequality that we're living through have nothing to do with individual effort or deservedness. These are deeply systemic inequalities that are the result of rigged rules in the economy, right? And yet, those powerful stories still persist. You may have noticed that data doesn't change people's minds, but powerful stories can resist all the data you provide. How do you do that? How do we change that? I have one clue. When I was involved in this campaign to defend the estate tax, I got a call from Bill Gates up the road in Seattle, Bill Gates Sr., the father of the founder of Microsoft. And he said, let me help this campaign to defend the estate tax. And he, true to his word, he went out and he helped organize, and we got 1,500 multimillionaires and billionaires to step up and to defend the estate tax from repeal under George W. Bush. And in the process of that, we did these different press conferences around the country. And at one of the press conferences, we had a business leader named Martin Rothenberg stand up and speak. And he said, "My name is Martin. I grew up in a community. My parents had no money. I was from a working class community. But today I'll have to pay the estate tax. I'm that wealthy. But when I was growing up, our family had very little. And yet, I went to a great public school, and I had science teachers that captured my imagination. And I went to a library that was open on the weekends and in the evenings. And that library became my sanctuary. And when I went to that library, there was this librarian who, for some reason, Martin says, took an interest in him. And she would say, Martin, I have a book for you. And she knew Martin was interested in science and technology, so it was a biography of a scientist or a book of experiments he could do in his apartment without burning it down. Martin says, my family had no money. Someone else paid for my education. Someone else paid for that librarian to be there. And then he went to college and he got a debt-free college education. Martin says, someone else paid for me to be able to go to college. And then he went to into the field of emerging new technologies, the internet technology, a field that was largely built through public investments. And Martin said, you know, I started a company. And at then one point, a foreign corporation stole my intellectual property. It's going to put me out of business. And the United States government went to my defense and sued to protect my intellectual property in a global tribunal, saving my company. Says, I didn't even know this infrastructure existed, but someone else paid to make it possible. So then Martin looks out at this press conference. He says, so last year I sold my company for $30 million. And I have several other companies worth the same amount. But what you're telling me is if you abolish the estate tax, you're basically saying I have no responsibility to pay back the society that made it almost entirely possible for me to get where I am. At this point, Martin starts to pound the podium. He says, I have a moral obligation to pay back so that some other young person out there who was born into the same humble circumstances as I could have the same opportunities I have. Because what a good society does is it recycles opportunity. And if you have the good fortune to have $10 million, $20 million, $50 million or more, you didn't do it alone. Your wealth may come from your own efforts and partially your own applied gifts, but you operate in a society that created, through public investments, a fertile ground that made your individual wealth possible. People like me, Martin says, should pay back the society so others can have the same opportunities we did. To me, that is the story that disrupts the I did it alone and I don't owe anybody anything story. It is the story of the web, public investments, family support, all the ways in which people get help. And so one of the things that I encourage people to do, wherever they are, is to try to lift up and tell true stories of how Advantage works and demystify and disrupt the story of individual deservedness. Let me close with a thought, and then I look forward to your thoughts and questions. I've had this opportunity to go out and talk to some very wealthy audiences. And I've had the opportunity to talk to labor unions and student groups and workers. My message to my own peers, my own one percenters, if you will, is this. It's time to come home. It's time to come home and put your stake in the commonweal. Put your stake in a place and work to ensure that everybody's children have the same opportunities as your children. It's time for the wealthy to bring the wealth home, to bring it out of the offshore tax havens and the hidden global casino and bring it back to the real economy, to local communities, to the new food systems and new economy enterprises that employ and create real jobs, not fake, phony wealth. It's time to share the wealth and share generously through philanthropy, but recognize philanthropy is not a substitute for a progressive tax system and an adequately funded public sector. So pay your fair share of taxes. Stop using every loophole. Stop hiring lawyers and wealth defenders to game the system. Pay your fair share. Tell true stories of how Advantage works. And recognize that you don't want to live in a society with an economic and racial apartheid pulling apart. It is in no one's interest, including you. And that's the message I took when I wrote Born on Third Base for a couple of years, talking to groups of wealthy individuals. But my message to everyone else is it's time to get organized. It's time to defend our communities against this hyper-extractive capitalism that we're living through, that's hoovering up the wealth of nature, the wealth of workers, the wealth of our communities. It's time to come together and organize. In that process, I want you to remember that there are some wealthy people who may be your potential allies. There are some unreachable wealthy. There are some hardcore cases that will not be on our side. There are people who use their wealth and power to rig the rules to get more wealth and power, but they are not the majority. There are lots of people waiting to be invited to something bigger and more meaningful than consumption. And they need to be invited home. You can invite them home to rejoin humanity. So that's part of my message, is we can find those allies and deploy them. You see, I know from my own experience, privilege is a disconnection drug. Privilege keeps people apart. When you grow up in the circumstances I did, you are buffered from real relationships of reciprocity and interdependence, and it creates a distance. The alternative, the antidote, is connection, is to being invited home. So think of people like me as your long-lost cousins who haven't been at the family reunion in 30 years or maybe a generation or two, and invite us back to rejoin humanity, to roll up our sleeves, fight together to protect the environment, to reduce and reverse these extreme inequalities. It is by no means too late. We can reverse the trajectory. We can change the stories that hold inequality in place. But we need to be together and to be bold. Thank you.
This is KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon. Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. You've been listening to Chuck Collins, recorded here in Eugene, Oregon, on April 17th of this year by Todd Boyle. You can get the rest of that on Todd Boyle's YouTube site. And this will be uploaded on radioforall.net, an independent media center project. Please support independent media in all its forms. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends that stock is cheap for this week. Isn't it peculiar that the rich, that it's always the aristocracy throughout history? It's always been the aristocracy that has always been the problem. Isn't that strange, peculiar?
Have you ever been broke?
Sure, mostly often.
All right. You're walking along. Not a nickel in your jeans. You're free as the wind. Nobody bothers you. Hundreds of people pass you by in every line of business. Shoes, hats, automobiles, radios, furniture, everything. And they're all nice, lovable people. And they let you alone. Well, is that right? Then you get a hold of some dough and what happens? All those nice, sweet, lovable people become helots. A lot of heels. They begin creeping up on you, trying to sell you something. They get long claws, and they get a stranglehold on you. And you squirm, and you duck, and you holler, and you try to push them away, but you haven't got a chance. They got you. First thing you know, you own things. A car, for instance. Now your whole life is messed up with a lot more stuff. You get license fees, and number plates, and gas, and oil, and taxes, and insurance, and identification cards, and letters, and bills, and flat tires, and dents, and traffic tickets, and motorcycle cops, and courtrooms, and lawyers, and fines, and a million and one other things. And what happens? You're not the free and happy guy you used to be. You gotta have money to pay for all those things. So you go after what the other fellas got. And there you are. You're a helot yourself.
You win, Colonel. Here, take the 50. Go out and get rid of it.
You bet I will, just as fast as I can. I'm going to get some canned goods, a fishing rod, and the rest I'm going to give away. Give away?
Hey, get me a pitcher's glove. I got to get some practice.
Say, he's giving it away. I'm going to get me some of that.
Hey, come back here, you helot.